if you really want to practically make your case to the American people, that has to involve going to where they're consuming media.
Republicans want House Speaker John Boehner to sell his fiscal cliff solutions outside the safe confines of Fox News. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Zero Dark 30. Some say the new film about Bin Laden's capture makes a misleading case for torture.
Tens of millions of people are going to see this film, and a lot of them are going to walk out of the theater saying coercive interrogation somehow led to Bin Laden.
And a look inside the dysfunctional relationship between the fugitive tycoon John McAfee and the media that love him.
It starts off like a great marriage. You're the guy who wants to tell a story. He's the guy who wants to be talked about. Let's take a walk together.
All that and more coming up next.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
Hello, podcast listeners. As we approached the immovable deadline for finishing this week's show, news of the Connecticut shooter was breaking. Reports from everywhere, citing anonymous authorities who first named one man, then his brother, often accompanied by dubious Facebook photos. We couldn't address it in time for the feed of our broadcast hour, but we did explore some of the issues raised by that early coverage. So the first interview you'll hear is available only on podcast. After that, you'll hear the broadcast version of On the Media. Now I'll pass the mic to Bob.
On Friday, amid the horror in Newtown, Connecticut, an unnamed law enforcement source, speaking unofficially, identified the shooter as Ryan Lanza. Thereupon, in newsrooms and dorm rooms and kitchen tables everywhere, Googlers Googled Ryan Lanza. Some found a Facebook page for a Ryan Lanza who grew up in Connecticut, and within moments, photos of a young man in heavy fleece and light whiskers was whisking around the globe. His name was named in press reports. His picture was on TV. Among those identifying him were CBS News, Fox News Channel, CNN, Slate, and The Huffington Post. Only trouble was, the dead child murderer was not Ryan Lanza, who happened to be alive and not in Connecticut on Friday. And it wasn't just Facebook that was raided for insights into the mind of a not-killer. Jeff Jarvis, noted social media journalist and director and professor at the Tao Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at City University of New York, located the Twitter feed of someone named Ryan Lanza and found some dark, foreboding messages. That young man felt alienated and desperate. He wished for the whole world to come to an end. And so Jarvis himself tweeted about the eerie clues embedded in the 140-character despondency. Only, once again, they were not the tweets of the shooter.
I saw a Twitter feed allegedly from the person named as the shooter, then thought to be a Ryan Lanza, and saw eerie moments in it. Now, I did not want to send out that address, neither did I want to name that person, and so I went on Twitter and I simply said that it was strange reading. I should have put the classic journalistic caveat in there and saying that a Twitter feed reputedly from the shooter or reputedly from the alleged killer. We're all taught in journalism school to use those caveats to make clear that we don't necessarily have all the facts yet. And I went with the casual of Twitter and I just left out the allegedly. I didn't put his name in. I didn't put the address of the Twitter feed in on purpose because just for that reason, I thought it could change. I should have added the caveat and I did not. And then people came back to me in an instant and said, well, there were reports already that it wasn't his feed. I deleted that tweet only so it couldn't get repeated again, though I hate doing that, and immediately apologized and said I should have said this was the reputed feed. Sometime later, the name changed in the news. Meanwhile, there were later tweets on that feed. So people came on Twitter and said, well, look, it couldn't possibly be him. Because there are later tweets. Well, yes and no. In fact, on Twitter, you can time delay tweets, so there's kind of no reality here. There's no way to know for sure. And all that means is that everyone, journalists and Twitter users alike, need to exert the caution of acknowledging what's not known yet.
The conclusions you jumped to and the speed with which you acted on them created a fairly small-scale problem. Whoever transmitted the photos from the Facebook page of Ryan Lanza did on a much larger scale with much greater consequences what you did. Because of the dangers of instantaneous transmission, shouldn't the digital journalists you teach be warned off of that send button despite their instincts to be first with the most?
One of the key skills of a journalist today is not to say what we know, but to say what we don't know. That's been the case since 24-hour cable news came along, where everyone becomes a witness to a story as it unfolds. And those of us who were reporters back in the day of pay telephones and notebooks know that oftentimes, by the time our deadline came around, we learned a lot more. And we were saved from many instant errors because of the time and structure of the press. Well, that's gone now, both because of 24-hour cable news and now because of the internet, and further gone because anyone can do this. So it's not just about training journalists. When that photo gets tweeted and retweeted and retweeted, same difference. Doesn't matter that a journalist did it. So I think we have a larger job and a bigger challenge, which is to make sure that everyone knows that you can't trust what you learn immediately, and that if you do choose to spread it, then you have a responsibility to say how you know what you know.
Your first answer to me when we started this conversation sounded an awful lot like, oops, oh well.
No, it's saying instead that we all have to learn the lesson. It's part of news literacy today to know that any story is a changing and moving object, and that what gets passed around instantly is not necessarily the final fact of it. That when we watched a mine disaster in West Virginia and thought most of the people had survived when in fact most had died, that's a story we saw unfold in its horrible mistake on the air as it happened. Or look at the recent case in the UK of a legislator who was accused of being a pedophile, who in fact was not. And everyone who retweeted that allegation is now being contacted by his lawyers under libel laws in the UK, which, as we know, are quite strict. So it can be certainly more than an oops, because it can affect someone's life, and it can come back around in legal action.
One of the things you did after you realized your error was delete the original tweets.
I cannot stand doing that.
Yeah.
And the only reason I did it was because in Twitter, you're not provided the means to go in and correct a tweet or to amend it. So the problem is it could keep on getting passed around. I mean, all I did was one tweet in which I said that an unnamed Twitter account was eerie to read. That's all I did. I didn't name the Twitter account. I didn't name the person. But even that was too much. And if that got passed around and again, you're part of that flow of mistakes on Twitter. I wish Twitter would let you go in and put up a correction. That's the proper way. That's the ethic we've learned in media and online, is that one should leave one's mistakes there for the world to see and correct them so that you can see the trail of the error. But that's not possible on Twitter.
I got to ask you this, Professor. What have you learned?
That the journalistic language of allegedly and reputedly is there for a reason, and that I should use it at all times, not just when in print.
You know, Jeff, I just want to clarify. I'm not suggesting that oops, oh well, is the wrong answer. It sounds horrible. It sounds insensitive and callous and arrogant, but it just might be a statement of reality, no?
No, I still don't think so. I think that's a bit too cynical, even in this case. I think that journalists make an effort to get their facts right. But journalists also do make mistakes. Part of the problem in the past of journalism was this notion that we didn't make mistakes, that we ran away from mistakes. Craig Silverman, you have on your show regularly, who is wonderful in his blog and book, Regret the Error, have you write the foreword for his book. And as I thought about mistakes, I remember back to my days as a Cub reporter, where when you made a mistake, it was so shameful, you tried to hide from it. You hoped it wasn't revealed. And what I've learned from Craig Silverman in thinking about this is that when you confess your mistakes, you in fact increase your credibility because you're more likely to be trusted to do it the next time. We all do make mistakes. That's not an oh well or an oops. It's an unfortunate reality. The question then is, what do we do about it at that moment? And what do we do about it in the future? How do we learn from that? How do we try to prevent that next mistake? But will we make mistakes? Yes, that you can be sure of.
Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Jeff Jarvis, who blogs at buzzmachine.com, is the director and professor of the Tao Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. With the fiscal cliff fight in its umpteenth week, President Obama is making his case in appearances throughout the country, as his principal adversary, House Speaker John Boehner, is laying out his argument in press conferences and on TV. Well, on one channel, anyway.
We've put a serious offer on the table by putting revenues up there to try to get this question resolved. But the White House has responded with virtually nothing.
Some Republican strategists criticize Boehner, who's stayed off the Sunday talk shows and the Today Show, for preaching only to the choir. BuzzFeed's politics editor McKay Coppins has been following that internal strategy debate. In fact, you quote conservative media strategist Keith Apple saying that Boehner should have blitzed all five Sunday shows and then done the Today Show the next morning. And then he said, "Are you telling me he can't handle Matt Lauer?"
Right. I mean, I think that this is a real frustration that a lot of people have. And I write in the story about some conservative leaders who've talked to reporters at the Huffington Post, BET News, Univision, places where you have not naturally Republican constituencies, but, you know, some think that if they had Republicans regularly making their case and defending their positions on those outlets, you might be able to convert a few of them to conservatism.
Is this a relatively new post-election point of view? Because you wrote about the case where Republican John Huntsman was criticized for doing an interview with a left-leaning Huffington Post. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what he said, but where he said it that made him a marked man.
Right, right. This is part of the Republican soul-searching that we've seen since Election Day. You know, the party is looking to rebrand itself, to reinvent itself. Mitt Romney, we heard during the campaign in that video talk about the 47% of Americans who would never vote for a Republican, right? Romney got a lot of flack for that, but that mindset is pretty prevalent in the Republican Party, and it translates to which media outlets they talk to.
But do they have a point? Slate's Dave Weigel wrote that Boehner actually had very little to gain by stepping out, that people tune into the messages they want to hear, regardless of where they originate. Does he have a point?
I mean, sure, there's a lot of selective media consumption out there, but John Boehner's a tough guy. He gives pretty good interviews. Why not take the case to, like this strategist said, all five Sunday shows? You might not convert a ton of people on the fiscal cliff. Republicans' positions are generally unpopular in this specific debate right now. But it could set the foundation for a long-term outreach strategy, which would include, you know, constantly making your case to people who might not otherwise hear what they have to say. I mean, if you're somebody who watches BET or MSNBC, you're likely to hear a lot more Democratic talking points than Republican talking points. Is that a reflection of the bias of the network, or is it a reflection of the fact that Republicans just never go on there to make their case?
Oh, come on. It's partly a reflection of the bias of the network.
Oh, of course. I think that when it comes down to it, a lot of political strategists that I quote in this story basically say, regardless of whether we're right about their bias, the point is a lot of people consume media through these outlets, and we need to go where the people are if we're going to start winning elections again.
There are some Republicans who embrace the idea that they should get out there. Republican stalwart John McCain is one, and up-and-comer Marco Rubio is another, right?
Florida Senator Marco Rubio is somebody who's been identified as a politician who understands this. During the Republican National Convention, for example, he did two interviews with Univision, a sit-down interview with Black Entertainment Television. He's also done a couple interviews with The Daily Show. and BuzzFeed has hosted him in our headquarters.
That just proves he's a media floozy.
I won't go that far, but I think that, you know, they were good interviews. I mean, you saw the hosts and reporters kind of challenge him on a lot of things, and he stood his ground and made his case.
Let's get back to the fiscal cliff for a second. Do you think that a good case is being made by the Republicans where Democrats can see it anywhere?
You look at the polling here, and the objective data shows that Republicans are kind of losing the argument on the fiscal cliff. They're against raising tax rates for people who make over $250,000, and the majority of Americans are in favor of that. The majority of Americans have even said that they disapprove of the way Republicans have handled the fiscal cliff negotiations. But they certainly have a case to make. And I think that when you poll a lot of these questions separately from the fiscal cliff and from the current cast of characters involved, you find that some Republican positions are actually more popular than they're showing right now. So clearly there is a problem with the way they're making the case and the places they're going to make their case.
You quote in your piece a number of Republican strategists who are, quote, urging their leaders to start carrying their message to media outlets that aren't named after a certain bushy-tailed woodland carnivore. Do you think they're having any impact?
A lot of the strategists that I quote weren't involved directly in 2012. They didn't have a lot of candidates. Washington, in this way, kind of goes in cycles. So a lot of the people who kind of stood on the sidelines in 2012 will get their turn during the midterms coming up and in 2016. So yeah, I think they have a voice that people are listening to. Since this story has been published, I've already heard from a number of staffers on the Hill who are saying, we need to make a bigger effort to get our message out. Certainly, nobody is thinking of abandoning Fox News. But a lot of people think that it's time to move on beyond Fox News as well.
McKay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
McKay Coppins is BuzzFeed's political editor. The new film, Zero Dark Thirty, has been controversial since long before its release. It's the story of the American intelligence community's decade-long hunt for Osama bin Laden.
Can I be honest with you? I am bad news. I'm not your friend. I'm not going to help you. I'm going to break you.
First, Republican Congressman Peter King pointed the finger at the White House, charging that director Kathryn Bigelow and screenwriter Mark Bowl had too much access to classified documents. Then, amid some grumblings that the film would unfairly boost President Obama's reelection chances, the film's studio delayed wide release of the movie from October to January. This week, the screening of the film for critics and journalists has yielded a new headline, that the depicted use of torture to get to bin Laden is dangerously misleading. Peter Bergen is the author of Manhunt, the 10-year search for Osama bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. He screened an early cut of the film as an unpaid advisor and wrote about it on CNN.com this week. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
So before the release of the movie, Kathryn Bigelow told The New Yorker's Dexter Filkins that she and screenwriter Mark Bowl were taking a, quote, almost journalistic approach to the film. So is this an almost piece of journalism?
It's a movie. And in a sense, Kathryn Bigelow and Mark Bowl, who are obviously incredibly talented and smart individuals, have set themselves up for a discussion of how accurate the film is by making claims that it is journalistic. And I mean, it's a great movie. Let's start with that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to say about it that's good. I felt that the half an hour at the beginning of the film of a detainee being abused didn't really represent what really happened in the hunt for bin Laden. It's not really my feeling either, Brooke. It's the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's the chairperson, and Carl Levin, the chairperson of the Armed Services Committee. They have done a 3-year investigation. They've written a 6,000-page report, which hasn't been released. They have said publicly that coercive interrogations didn't lead to bin Laden.
The filmmakers suggest that torture led to important clues that ultimately led to the apprehension of bin Laden. Of course, there was a long road from those first clues to actually getting to Abbottabad, but it started there, and that's where the argument is.
The story is much more complicated. The film does go into clues that came from a foreign intelligence service, direction-finding technology that led to the courier, human spies that followed the courier to where bin Laden lived. But the fact is, and I certainly don't think the filmmakers intended this, tens of millions of people are going to see this film, and a lot of them are going to walk out of the theater saying coercive interrogation somehow led to bin Laden.
You saw an early cut of the film, and along with others, you told the filmmakers that the torture scenes were, I think in your word, overwrought. They listened. They toned down, you say, some of the bloodier scenes?
I had this reaction. One or two other people who were in this rather small group of people had the same reaction. As a result, I think they did. When I saw the final cut, it didn't seem quite as visceral.
The film claims to be based on actual events. Is there a central figure, a woman like Maya, who put so many of these pieces together and drove the agencies to Abbottabad?
There was a woman who appears, her name is Jen, in the book No Easy Day.
No Easy Day was written by one of the Navy SEALs.
Right. So she was obsessed by finding bin Laden. She was always sure that he was living in Abbottabad, even though a lot of other people didn't think so or were much less sure. That said, there's a male analog who goes by the pseudonym of John, who was always at 90% probability that bin Laden was in Abbottabad and worked on the case starting in 2003 and was completely obsessed about it too. So yes, there is this woman in real life, but there were also other people who played a real life role and they don't get a look in, but they wouldn't. I mean, you'd be doing War and Peace on steroids if you told the whole story.
This actually strikes me as quite interesting. You have this film and you have, I'll say it, the Showtime series Homeland, and both are built around brilliant, obsessed, effective, also relatively isolated women. Is this a reflection of reality?
Well, I've met many women who work at the CIA. Gina Bennett, who was the first person within the intelligence community in 1993 to flag a guy called Osama bin Laden. Right from the beginning of the bin Laden unit, it was made up of largely women who were regarded as being sort of on a jihad to find bin Laden. They were sort of ridiculed for that in the pre-9/11 era.
You, Peter, wrote maybe the most definitive book about this subject. You'd met Osama bin Laden. But movies wind up being the way most of us remember how things happened.
There have been many books written about it, and many books will be written about it. That said, 50,000 people may go out and buy my book, and you know, probably tens of millions of people will see this film around the world.
Are you glad it was made?
Yeah. We'll leave the theater with a pretty good summary about the war on terror told through the CIA lens. I think it's raised this issue again in the public debate, and it might have the useful effect of prying loose this 6,000-page report the Senate Intelligence Committee has been working on for 3 years, which will actually settle some of these questions.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter Bergen is the author of Manhunt, the 10-year search for Osama bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad, and executive producer of the documentary Manhunt, which will be showing for the first time at Sundance in January.
Coming up, how a crucial link between apes and man found 100 years ago turned out instead to be the weakest link imaginable.
We'll look at how it evolved. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We'll launch this part of the show with a confession and a correction. The confession, simply that I made a mistake in last week's show. The show, inevitably make mistakes, which we correct by marking the offending section in our transcripts accessible at onthemedia.org and then correct at the bottom of that page. That way people can see the original and the fixed version. And we also have a corrections page. Anyway, last week I made a mistake, and for a nerd like myself, it's a doozy. I was interviewing astrophysicist Martin Rees about a host of existential threats humans need to consider, including the rise of intelligent machines. And we used a clip from the first Terminator movie with hero Kyle Rees to illustrate. I jokingly remarked that Kyle and Martin Rees were not related. That's when I blew it. Listener Ralph Kohler from Oneida, New York, laid it out in an email. He's on the line. Hi, Ralph. Can you read the letter?
Sure. I love On the Media, and I love the Terminator. But you said, Martin Rees, no relation to Kyle Rees. I'm disappointed by this bit of sloppy reporting, and I really expected better of you. Since Kyle is from the future, it's entirely possible that Kyle is related to Martin. In fact, given their shared interest in apocalyptic machines, it seems likely that Martin's interest will someday play a key role in Kyle's survival. I still love the show, listening to you through a series of automated cybernetic systems that deliver your podcast to me without human intervention.
I'm glad we haven't lost you, Ralph. Can you describe the moment when you heard that heinous mistake?
I realized it instantly, but I thought about it for about 5 minutes into the next segment, and then rewound it and listened to it again, and tapped out the note right away. It's the sort of thing that I really expected 100 other emailers to send in.
You really seem to understand this subject very well. What do you do for a living?
I actually develop automated surveillance and munitions delivery systems for the Department of Defense. Essentially, I work on killer robots.
For the Defense Department?
Yes.
Ralph, it's a pleasure meeting you, and I promise I'll never make this mistake again.
Thanks a lot, Brooke. It was a pleasure.
That was listener Ralph Kohler. Please, if you hear something, say something, or at least email it to onthemedia@wnyc.org.
So, yeah, OTM arrogantly overlooked the time-space continuum, and for that we unreservedly apologize. I regret to say, however, that we are not alone in making mistakes. Each year at this time, we call on Craig Silverman, author of the Poynter Institute's Regret the Error column, to review the most notable media mea culpas of the previous 12 months. Craig, welcome back, man.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the big one. For Error of the Year, you chose an unusually high-profile mistake. Both CNN and Fox News erroneously reported that the Supreme Court had struck down the individual mandate for the president's health care program.
That's right. It was very hotly anticipated. Everybody prepared for it. And on game day, CNN and Fox News both made the same mistake, while other folks, Bloomberg, Reuters, and others, they got it right. I mean, obviously, you don't see CNN and Fox News come together on a lot of things, so I suppose that in itself is notable. But the fact that they fell down at such a big moment for a breaking news story, that made it a very big mistake. And then the second part was, you know, how did they deal with it? And that in and of itself was also something that was kind of notable.
Because?
Well, CNN acknowledged they got it wrong. They apologized for that mistake. Fox News wasn't really going to go down that road. So rather than apologize, they actually sort of doubled down on it and said, listen, you know, as Chief Justice Roberts was reading this out, he said that it wasn't valid under the way that everyone expected it would be declared valid. So we declared that it was, you know, invalid at that moment. The key thing here was that there was a surprise in the decision that it was upheld as a tax. And that was a possibility, but it really wasn't a big thing that people were expecting. And so the producer that Fox News had reading the decision in the room read that it was invalid, failed to turn the page, and then discovered that, oh, wait a second, but it's valid as a tax. And so Fox News has actually sort of blamed it on Chief Justice Roberts and the way that the decision was read out, rather than admitting that, listen, you know, our producer jumped the gun a bit, which is what happened there and also what happened with CNN.
All right. Now, most of the mistakes you flagged in this year's year-end column weren't so high profile, and the stakes were not nearly so high. Your correction of the year was a small one. You tell me what it related to.
The Economist, very well-known magazine, of course, had an article looking at sort of the habits of drinking at work. You know, the old martini lunch, and, you know, the story was called The Boredom of Boozeless Business. The subhead was The Sad Demise of the Three Martini Lunch. And so it was one of these pieces looking at sort of what have we lost without people coming back from lunch sloshed at the desk. And at one point in the story, they said that journalists at Bloomberg's Businessweek magazine could actually be disciplined for sipping a spritzer at work. Bloomberg Businessweek's editor got out on Twitter and he said, listen, you know, this is wrong. We drink all the time, jokingly, of course, and this needs to be corrected. He also said something about having his vengeance on The Economist. So this resulted in a correction from The Economist that read, an earlier version of this article claimed that journalists at Bloomberg Businessweek could be disciplined for sipping a spritzer at work. This is not true. Sorry, we must have been drunk on the job.
Okay. Now, that's your correction of the year. My correction of the year came courtesy of the New York Times, which exercised enormous ex post facto rigor in setting the record straight in a story involving two young people with Asperger's syndrome.
This was, in the end, the most viral correction of the year. But it was actually published in very, very late December 2011. So I have to be a stickler for accuracy on this. I hope everyone understands that it is not eligible for correction of the year 2012. But it was definitely the most viral correction of 2012 because in early January, it started spreading like crazy. So here is the correction from the New York Times. An article on Monday about Jack Robison and Kirsten Linsmith, two college students with Asperger's syndrome who are navigating the perils of an intimate relationship, misidentified the character from the animated children's TV show My Little Pony that Miss Linsmith said she visualized to cheer herself up. It is Twilight Sparkle, the nerdy intellectual, not Fluttershy, the kind animal lover.
Oh, my God. Had they only been so accurate and precise leading up to the war in Iraq. You know what I'm saying? And as you say, it went crazy viral. What is it about this correction that is just so gripping?
I think part of it you sort of hinted at, which is the idea that, number one, the New York Times is going to run a correction in correcting the name of a My Little Pony character. So that in and of itself is something. The second part, I think, is the way it's written. There's this long buildup of, you know, the two college students and talking about Asperger's syndrome and, you know, the perils of navigating an intimate relationship. And all of it leads up to basically a punchline of Twilight Sparkle, the nerdy intellectual, and Fluttershy, the kind animal lover. So I think that they really recognized the possibility here and they executed well.
Now, there's one in your column that made me laugh out loud, and it is from Vogue. Permit me to read this.
Yes.
In the September profile of Chelsea Clinton, Waiting in the Wings by Jonathan Van Meter, Dan Bayer was mistakenly identified as an interior designer. He is a deputy assistant secretary for the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor at the U.S. Department of State.
It's close, you know. Everyone would have understood it a bit more if Dan Bayer had worked at, you know, at the Interior Ministry.
Department of Interior.
Like
I was waiting for it. No. Can we end this by reading the correction about the late author E.B. White?
This was my runner-up for Best Numerical Error of the Year, a correction from the New York Times. Correction. An earlier version of this article misidentified the number of years E.B. White wrote for The New Yorker. It was five decades, not centuries. If only we could all have such a long and fruitful career.
Craig, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman writes the Regret the Error column for the Poynter Institute.
Years ago this week, at a special meeting of the Geological Society in London, a stunning revelation. The possible discovery of the holy grail of paleoanthropology, the missing link between ape and man. A human-like skull and an ape-like jaw fragment had been found in a gravel pit in the hamlet of Piltdown, England, and they were believed to be 500,000 years old. Despite some initial doubts that the fragments came from the same specimen, the so-called Piltdown Man became a widely accepted link in the chain of evidence of human evolution. Accepted, that is, until four decades later, when Piltdown was exposed as a total fraud. Evan Haddingham is senior science editor at NOVA, well-versed in this historic hoax. At the center of the story, he says, was a man named Charles Dawson.
Charles Dawson was a well-to-do solicitor who lived in the town of Lewes in Sussex, one of the richest areas in the whole of Britain for geological and archaeological finds. And so in this town was a thriving group of amateur collectors. They were highly competitive. Dawson had been roaming the downs for decades, and every now and then he'd send some curious discovery to Arthur Smith Woodward, who was the curator at the British Museum of Natural History in London.
And Smith Woodward lent a lot of credibility to the Piltdown discovery, even though scientists suspected that the skull and the mandible actually came from different skeletons.
There was some initial skepticism about the find, but every time a serious point of debate was raised, lo and behold, a piece of fossil would crop up almost miraculously, which answered some of the objections that called the find into question.
But interestingly, it was foreigners who were more skeptical than the Brits. And this brings us to the political context.
Well, 1912, it's before the outbreak of the Great War, of course, which shook up the values of all the imperial powers. So it's still the height of the British Empire. Playing into a sense of national pride was the notion that perhaps England had been the entire center for the origin of humanity. Surely it was about time that Britain had its own discovery on par with those that had been found in Germany with the Neanderthals and so on.
There wasn't just a political context. There was also the prevailing notions of racial differences when this discovery was made.
There was probably unconscious racist overtones in that continuing willingness to believe that Piltdown was a true discovery. In the 1920s, the first discoveries were made of ancestral humans in southern Africa. And they were very easy to reject because even though Darwin thought that Africa was the probable place of origin for humanity, it was far more comfortable to think of this man-ape in England being a formative character in our past as opposed to a place like Africa.
Since Piltdown was exposed as a hoax in 1953, people have floated theories about who the hoaxer was. Some have implicated Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
The fun part about Piltdown is the dozen or so suspects that have been paraded around. And by far the most exotic candidate is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the famous author of Sherlock Holmes. The evidence that Conan Doyle had anything to do with this consists mostly in parallels in Conan Doyle's famous tale, The Lost World, about a lost colony of ancient humans that coexisted with the dinosaurs on a plateau in South America in the present day. Conan Doyle did know Dawson. They did lunch together. And Conan Doyle may have chatted to Dawson about his developing idea for this exciting novel. And it's possible that that actually planted the idea of the hoax in Dawson's mind, not the other way around.
Why did Smith Woodward never begin to doubt Piltdown? Anytime anyone ever found anything, Dawson was always there.
Dawson expertly played on the expectations of the scientists in London. He played up the image of himself as an enthusiastic, knowledgeable amateur. He really charmed Smith Woodward. Smith Woodward also invested a huge amount of his reputation and career in Piltdown. For over 20 years, he dug every summer, rather sadly, never finding anything again. So during Smith Woodward's lifetime, it was very unlikely that anybody would critically examine the remains. But in 1948, he died.
So that brings us to the late 40s and early 50s. A couple of scientists tried to assess the Piltdown remains. What sort of high-tech CSI techniques were available to them at the time that weren't available before?
They ran the relatively newly discovered radiocarbon test, and the shocking truth finally came out. It was a modern jaw of an orangutan. And the skull fragments belong to a modern human, possibly from a medieval cemetery. And once suspicions about the date were raised, they did something really basic, which was to really examine the teeth of the jaw under a magnifying glass. And lo and behold, it was obvious that they'd been filed flat. And that was why they didn't resemble an ape's tooth.
Now, you've actually seen those teeth. Does it strain your credulity to think that people wouldn't have seen that before? Because you've said it's a pretty crude file job.
It's astonishing when you look at the remains that are still there, kept in a drawer in the British Museum of Natural History. The most obvious piece of the fraud was a canine tooth that was found in 1913, planted by Dawson a year after the first remains. Because you can't stain a tooth the way you can bone, the hoaxer actually used paint on the root of the tooth. What looks obvious today wasn't at all obvious to the specialists back then because of their expectations.
So in terms of scientific hoaxes, is there anything that compares to Piltdown?
Not really. Piltdown still stands as the preeminent story of scientific skullduggery.
Pun not intended.
Sorry. Anyway, it really did have an extraordinary influence on the way we saw human evolution. It fooled the scientific community for four decades, and there's been nothing like that ever since.
What drew you so deeply into the Piltdown story?
It's the ultimate Agatha Christie story. Charles Dawson had a well-documented and burning ambition to make his mark on the scientific world. People have looked at the other things that Dawson collected. And at the present time, I believe the count of fraudulent objects is 38. Spanning a couple of decades, Dawson had forged not just bones and stones, but Roman statuettes. And there was even a sea monster that he claimed to have seen crossing the English Channel. All of these things fall into the picture of a very smart but compulsively dishonest and manipulative collector. We really don't know the fine details of how Dawson did this, but there are wonderful, tantalizing clues planted throughout the huge literature and correspondence surrounding Piltdown. You can get completely lost in the search for hints in letters and so on. For anybody who loves masterpiece mystery, you can find all of that in the Piltdown story.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Evan Haddingham is senior science editor at WGBH's Nova and, as far as I can tell, an anatomically modern human.
Coming up, how a successful and shady software magnate beguiles the press.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Journalists first swarmed to John McAfee back in 1992 when he warned about the supposedly killer Michelangelo computer virus, a threat that never panned out, but which propelled his antivirus software company into the stratosphere. Next, he fascinated by pioneering aerotrekking, an adrenaline-rich but insanely dangerous sport of flying ultralight aircraft close to the ground. Next, he attracted attention by taking what was left of his $100 million fortune and decamping to an island off of Belize, where he lived a life of off-the-charts hedonism, including sex, drugs, and loaded guns. And now he is once again in the spotlight, this time as a person of interest in the murder of his neighbor, Gregory Fall. For almost a month, McAfee has been on the lam from authorities, but he is a counterintuitive fugitive. A procession of reporters has followed him virtually and in the flesh and enabled him to spin an unlikely counter-narrative. Through the latest chapter of McAfee outrageousness, as ever, news outlets like Vice, Wired, and the New York Times have flown toward him like moths to a flame-out. In fact, the publicity led to his capture in Guatemala. Rather than sending him back to Belize, though, Guatemalan authorities deported him Wednesday back to the United States. Science and adventure writer Jeff Wise has been covering McAfee for 5 years and continues to marvel at the man's ability to hijack the press's fascination for his own purposes.
He's tried to paint this picture of himself as an ordinary, fun-loving, peaceful guy whose only desire is to go back to fishing. He never was a fisherman before, but now he wants to go back to it. McAfee has spent all of his time in the last 3 weeks repeating a drumbeat of Belizean government corruption.
I was minding my own business in April when 42 armed soldiers stormed my property, shot my dog in front of my eyes, and just to show me that they were serious, destroyed $500,000 worth of property, tortured me in the sun by keeping my hands handcuffed behind my back with no relief for 14 hours. Again, I suggest you try this, people. Take me to a jail, release me with no charges, and then from that point on, they have been harassing me.
Because that is his message. It is repeated. Even by outlets that are somewhat critical, it is repeated.
At this point, we should observe that it is not from nothing that the Belizean police are suspicious of him. The suspicion is based on an ongoing dispute between McAfee and Greg Fault. And Fault was killed by a handgun. McAfee kept guns.
Carried
in his
guns
compound,
against the law.
Them, and, you know, was clearly erratic. So tell me when he went from being just a rich, devil-may-care eccentric to something darker.
So when I first met him in 2007, he seemed very much on the up and up, a guy who had a passion for this new sport called aerotrekking, which involved flying these tiny aircraft very low over the desert. And I wrote a very positive piece about him for a magazine called Outsides Go. And I went back to visit him after he moved to Belize. As I got to know him better, as people came forward and told me stories, it was like peeling an onion. As the layers came off, a darker side to him emerged. But it was a very slow process. And it's been quickened by changes in his own personality in the last few years. Around 2010, it seems he became involved in these things called bath salts, which are a powerful psychosis-inducing drug. He was attracted to them for their hypersexualizing effect, and it made him darker, I think. The first evidence was that his coterie of hangers-on and admirers went away. By the time I visited him in April of this year, he was alone in this sprawling compound right on the beach, and there was no one there to share it with him except his Belizean employees, some of whom appeared to be gunmen and prostitutes.
What are the ways that McAfee has succeeded in manipulating reporters, beginning with you?
He is very savvy in how the press works. He knows what kind of assertion will be printed uncritically. For instance, in 2009, I saw the coverage that said that McAfee had lost 96% of his wealth in the crash. I reached out to him. I wanted to find out what was going on. He said that he was perfectly happy. He'd moved down to Belize, and he was very excited about this project that he had gotten underway with a Harvard biologist. So he was going to find these miracle drugs in the jungle, invited me to come down. He said, we'll go flying, and I'll show you all these wonderful drugs that we're going to use to save the world. I went down there, and sure enough, we had fun on his boat, and we flew around the country, and I met this biologist, and he showed me the plots of land where he was going to grow these miracle herbs. And I wrote a piece that was really, frankly, credulous. I basically took what McAfee told me. I took what I'd seen, and I put it together in 3,000 words. And my editor, he said, this doesn't smell right. This needs more time. So let's hold it and do some more reporting.
What was he doing in Belize to begin with?
He had claimed that he had gone there to find these medical herbs. But as I reported, it turned out that there was a wrongful death lawsuit against him as a result of his aerotrekking operation that he had been trying to promote as a popular sport for Americans. It seemed to be a plausible potential explanation for why he had gone down there in the first place.
He's irresistible. And there's been this procession of reporters to see him. Most recently, the editor of Vice. Tell me about the photo from Guatemala.
This was a bizarre twist and a bizarre story. He'd been on the run for about 3 weeks. And then he invites a pair of journalists from Vice to travel with him. They took an iPhone picture and uploaded it. And the headline was, "We are with John McAfee, suckers." One of the readers noticed that the iPhone had automatically appended metadata to the image that showed exactly where it was taken, which turned out to be poolside at a resort in Guatemala. And so instantly it was on Twitter. McAfee responded to this lapse by claiming that he had deliberately faked this data to throw off his pursuers. And what was really objectionable to some people was that the photographer who took the picture, Robert King, who was on freelance assignment for Vice, backed up McAfee's claim. So they were not just in cahoots with McAfee at this point, but actually aiding and abetting.
What compact do you have to make with your news organization and with yourself before you get involved with covering him?
Just read what's already been written about this guy. You know, he is this person who's gone on the record that he enjoys hoaxing the press. I feel like as a member of the press, that should alert you.
Kind of a red flag.
It starts off like a great marriage. You're the guy who wants to tell a story. He's the guy who wants to be talked about. Let's take a walk together. Where it starts to break down is that McAfee also has a compulsion to manipulate people to do things that they don't want to do. He has done a masterful job, however you feel about him personally, of creating a narrative out of thin air, which has thousands or millions of adherents at this point. I guess I've seen a lot of coverage recently about McAfee where he's described as being a complicated character. And he's not really complicated. He's actually a kind of a simple character once you understand what's really motivating him.
So it's journalistically safe and explicitly non-libelous to say that, but maybe not doing a service to the reader.
I feel that in a case like this, you have to go out on a limb a bit. You cannot just be that ideal, balanced person who takes one person's opinion over here and matches it with this person's opinion over here, especially if you only have one person's opinion, if your only source is the subject.
Well, you've certainly learned how to go out on a limb because in one piece, you said, while I was with him, I had the distinct impression that he was going to murder me.
We were halfway through a conversation and he stopped and he said, Jeff, I'm going to tell you the truth for once. And he paused and he wound up making a phone call instead to these two gentlemen who had recently been taken in on a burglary charge. And he was saying, I'm going to get you out and I want you to come over to the island this afternoon. This was in the context of telling me about how he has all these killers essentially working for him. And he never finished that thought. And then I left and I sort of kissed the ground when I got back to my hotel. And he actually reached out to me the next day and he said, there was something that I wanted to tell you that was very important and I just forgot to tell you. And I'd like you to come back to my house so that I can tell you. There was no way in the world I was going to go back to his house. And I said to him, tell me over the phone. He said, I can't share with you something that's of such deep personal importance to me unless you're here. He sounded kind of mad at me. And I can't explain to somebody else why I felt so strongly that I had like a 50-50 chance of getting out of that alive. I think it's very plausible at the very least that he wanted me to feel like he wanted to kill me.
One final question. Does this guy even matter? Is there a story here beyond the freak show?
There's two ways of looking at that. Noam Cohen of the New York Times told me that if McAfee back in the day had decided to call his software Bluebird antivirus software, this story wouldn't exist. Mm-hmm. So in a way, no, it's completely inconsequential. He's not really a celebrity. People just know the name because it's popped up on their computer from time to time. On the other hand, there are people he has harmed who I believe right now are fearing literally for their lives. And I think that is a problem.
Jeff, thank you.
My pleasure.
Jeff Wise is a science and adventure writer. He has written frequently about John McAfee, most recently for the New York Times. Innocence of Muslims, the YouTube video that sparked violent protests in the Muslim world last September, is in the news again. After the deadly attack on the UN mission in Benghazi, UN Ambassador Susan Rice suggested on TV that the inflammatory film had caused the attack. It appears now that deliberate terrorism, not the spontaneous outrage the video spawned elsewhere, was behind the Benghazi violence. And on Thursday, under pressure from Senate Republicans, Rice removed herself from consideration for Secretary of State. Around the same time as the attack in Benghazi, an airing of a very different film about the Islamic faith caused a small riot in northern India. The Message is a multi-million dollar epic about the life of Muhammad, which debuted in the U.S. in 1977. The film could not be more different than Innocence of Muslims, yet it's the second time it's been connected to violence. The Message played a part in a bizarre, little-remembered terrorism incident on U.S. soil that now stands as an eerie foreshadowing for the riots that erupted 35 years later. The movie's producer, Syrian-American Mustafa Akkad, himself a Muslim, envisioned the film as a sweeping epic. Western viewers were not impressed.
Because they thought it was too dumbed down. They thought it was too sympathetic. The musical score, which was actually nominated for an Academy Award, was overly sympathetic towards Muhammad and his story.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, from Muhammad, the messenger of God, Greetings to him.
It was a pretty basic plot, pretty poorly acted. It's nothing compared to Lawrence of Arabia or similar epics from that era.
Maybe not Lawrence of Arabia, but quite the epic. The producer spent a lot of money, $17 million, $1977, to faithfully depict the roots of Islam.
He wanted to spread the story of Muhammad to a Western audience. And respecting Islamic tradition, he chose not to portray Muhammad in voice or an image throughout the film.
Muhammad is generous, yes. He gives, he shares. But he is spreading dangerous ideas.
Dangerous ideas? That no man should starve? That the rich should not defraud the poor? That the strong should not oppress the weak? Are these dangerous ideas?
And yet for all his good intentions, this film became a bargaining chip in this terrorist incident in Washington, D.C. in 77, when a group of Hanafi Muslims, that's American-born converts to Islam, seized three buildings in D.C., killed two people, and took almost 150 others hostage. Tell me about these Hanafis.
We should start with their leader, and his name was Hamad Abdul Khalis, and in the early 60s, he joined the Nation of Islam and actually rose through the ranks. He befriended Malcolm X. In the mid-60s, he broke with the Nation of Islam and formed the Hanafi Muslim Movement of America. They were based in Washington, D.C. In 1973, a hate crime is committed against Khalis, and several members of his family are murdered. And then 4 years later is when he storms and takes over three buildings in Washington. Sharpshooters surrounded the buildings that the Hanafis took over. President Carter was briefed on the situation. Even the State Department brought in ambassadors from Muslim countries to try to pacify the Hanafis. For 40 hours, the city was stopped.
One of the most remarkable aspects of this episode, the takeover of the B'nai B'rith and the Islamic Center and the district building, is that the whole thing played out on the local news, Channel 9, in real time, and its anchor man, Max Robinson, was very much in the middle of this story.
The terrorists established a telephone dialogue with Robinson, who was the first to broadcast their demands. Among other things, that a new movie about the Prophet Muhammad be banned.
But once the film is removed from this country, once you are asking that those responsible for the deaths or who killed your children be brought to the B'nai B'rith building.
They did not get the murderers to the district building. However, the message was stopped from premiering in New York on that same day.
And various governmental officials, including the ambassador to the United Nations, Andrew Young, and I think President Carter himself, publicly fretted over a press being so free that it gave so much oxygen to a terrorist incident.
In a strange way, shades of President Obama and Susan Rice this year, you have President Carter had to defend his UN ambassador's comments, who said that he wanted a law to restrict the flow of information, and he wanted the press not to be able to give a platform to these attackers.
Do you have any idea what it was in the message that infuriated the Hanafis? In particular, do you have any idea whether Khalis had actually even seen the film?
He was quoted as saying that he saw the message as the inspiration for him to act. Similar to the rhetoric concerning innocence of Muslims, he just called the film denigrating towards Islam and Muhammad. By all accounts, he probably did not see the film, considering it was on the day of its premiere.
Do you think the people who rioted in Kashmir and elsewhere in northern India had any idea that the message was not the innocence of Muslims?
I'm sure they had no idea, and almost 5 minutes into the film, or not even 5 minutes into the film, there's a slide that's shown that says, the image of Muhammad will not be shown in this movie. And so presumably this riot that occurred in India happened even before that five-minute mark in the film.
Akkad lost a fortune with the original production of the message, but he went on to do pretty well in Hollywood. He was the producer of what?
The Halloween movies starring Jamie Lee Curtis. And it's just, it's really, I think, symbolic in this whole story of mistaken intentions. Akkad tried so hard to make this large, high-budget epic, and it largely flopped and inspired violence. And then his next movie was this low-budget slasher movie, and it wound up grossing tens of millions of dollars and launching a franchise.
Malcolm, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to share this history.
Malcolm Burnley wrote about the message on Atlantic.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Krista Ripple and Annie Russell. And the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts and read our fabulous blog at onthemedia.org. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.